Trouble Between Two Allies, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Turkey's President Erdogan says the U.S. is stabbing his country in the back. It's the latest escalation of tensions between two once close NATO allies, and it's leading many Turks to question that relationship.
They are saying, why do we need the U.S.? Why do we need to be a part of NATO? We can just align ourselves with Russia and Iran. Even Erdogan is saying that.
Also, a veteran Western correspondent reflects on his 17 years covering Iran and explaining Iran to the outside world.
I often talk about Iran and I give a lecture for like an hour, and it's all about, you know, the economy and the middle class and statistics. And then in the end, people will always raise their hands and say, okay, but what is life like in Iran?
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Ever since Turkey joined NATO 66 years ago, it's been a steadfast ally of the United States. But today, Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, accused the U.S. of stabbing Turkey in the back. A dispute over a jailed American pastor has led to sanctions from the Trump administration. Those sanctions helped trigger a dramatic fall in the value of the Turkish currency, the lira, last week. And there are fears of an economic collapse. Journalist Fariba Nawa is in Istanbul. Fariba, Turkey and the U.S. have been allies for decades. Why are they squabbling now?
The main issue seems to be the pastor. His name is Andrew Brunson. He's an American pastor who's been jailed for the last 2 years on accusations of espionage and links to what Turkey considers are terrorist groups, such as the Kurdistan Workers Party or the PKK, a Kurdish separatist group, as well as the Gulen network that they accuse of masterminding the coup in 2016, the failed coup.
And he was arrested in 2016, right after the failed coup, wasn't he?
Yes, he was in October 2016, a few months after the coup.
And there was a chance he was going to be released, and then Erdogan said, no, we're keeping him for a while.
Yeah, I think it was the mediation process may have included a cultural misunderstanding from what I'm picking up as I talk to analysts. And it seems like in the Middle East, when people bargain, there's a gradual process of agreeing to things. I think Turkey expected to continue negotiating. And the United States, and particularly President Trump, became impatient after Turkey put Andrew Brunson under house arrest. But analysts here in Turkey say that that was just part of the process. They would have eventually released him. But what ended up happening is President Trump started to tweet and threaten Turkey with tariffs. And that just put Erdogan on defense immediately. Turkey felt humiliated in the process. And now it's a tit for tat between the two leaders as well as the two countries. In fact, even the Turkish opposition in some ways is united.
How serious is this row? I mean, could this damage U.S.-Turkish relations permanently?
That remains to be seen. I hope not. I hope that there is a solution. But I think the negotiations have pretty much fallen apart at this point. And it's immediately affecting the Turkish economy. And I was just out yesterday in a neighborhood in Istanbul in the markets where people, it's always full on a Sunday. It's before the Eid Muslim holiday here, just a week before. And usually the bazaars are bustling with people, but it was half empty. People are not buying. The Turkish lira dived because of this tit for tat or dispute between the U.S. and Turkey. And it's also affecting European and Asian markets right now. Even Germany's quite worried. And Angela Merkel just announced that we cannot allow the Turkish economy to fall apart.
But there's other issues. There's other reasons why the lira is falling as well, aren't there?
Yes, certain economic policies that the government has made has definitely contributed to this declining economy for the last couple of years. The nation is in deep debt. Inflation is rising at 15%. The problem with this diplomatic dispute is that it really accelerates what economic analysts had predicted in the first place. The ruling party and the ruling government and Erdogan are giving this narrative that we're strong, we've been through this before, and we're going to come through this despite our failing economy.
At this point, is there any talk in Turkey of ending the strategic military alliance with the U.S.?
the Turkish population is very resentful and angry right now against the United States. Yesterday, a video was being passed around burning dollars in southern Turkey. But there's no specific discussion of military information or military involvement. They are saying, why do we need the U.S.? Why do we need to be a part of NATO? We can just align ourselves with Russia and Iran. So there is a lot of that. It's just changing alliances, basically. Even Erdogan is saying that.
Is there any talk yet of something as dramatic as, say, you know, shutting down the airbase at Incirlik?
I haven't heard of that. I think that would be quite dramatic. And both sides are fairly hesitant to talk about that right now.
Journalist Fariba Nawa in Istanbul. Thanks a lot, Fariba.
Thank you, Carol.
Dutch journalist Thomas Erdbrink has been living and reporting in Iran for 17 years. You may have heard him on this program, giving us the view from the New York Times Bureau in Tehran. In 2014, Erdbrink got permission from the Iranian government to travel around the country with a film crew. And over the course of 4 years, filming the frontline documentary Our Man in Tehran, he followed the daily lives of many Iranians, including his Iranian wife's family.
In the beginning, Tehran seemed mysterious to me. And with its many walls and doors, it seemed an almost inaccessible city. But thanks to my marriage to Nusha, I discovered behind those barriers a completely different world.
I asked Thomas why he began the documentary in such a personal way, with a story about how he met his wife Nusha and the very lively scene of him having lunch with her family.
I actually did it intentionally in order to show people that beyond the high politics, beyond the nuclear case, beyond the sanctions, beyond the death to America, there are also normal people living here. I often talk about Iran and I give a lecture for like an hour and it's all about, you know, the economy and the middle class and statistics. And then in the end, people will always raise their hands and say, okay, but what is life like in Iran? How do you live there? And I guess that's what we started with. And we deal with all these difficult subjects later on, but all from the perspective of, you know, the average Iranians, of the guy who shouts death to America, of the woman who is divorced, of my family-in-law that just has lunch.
I want to talk about one of the real people you speak to several times, a religious hardliner. He's nicknamed Mr. Big Mouth, and when you see the documentary, you understand why. His views are really different from yours, yet you guys get along great, and he's very welcoming.
Well, it's definitely an Iranian thing that when you have guests, you have to treat them with the utmost respect. But Mr. Big Mouth is a man very convinced of his ideology. He's a man who says that even in his sleep, he wakes up and shouts, death to America and death to Israel. And I ask him why, and he says, well, because it gives me energy. But of course, to me, he is a symbol of some of the people in this country. Yeah, personally, I don't like to hear the things he said, but I like to hear from him, just like I like to hear from the divorced woman or from the people who are suffering from drought or other things. Because in the end, he's one of the guys we would see on the front pages of our newspapers when it says another demonstration in Iran.
What he seems to be really afraid of is change. Give us an example of the kind of changes he was afraid of.
He was mostly afraid of what he would call Westernization. The changes that we actually have been experiencing also everywhere in the Western world in the last 15 years, globalization, cheap travel, satellite TV, the internet, all those things that make the world smaller and maybe in the eyes of Mr. Big Mouth, a less unique place. And he was afraid that under the influence of all those things, women would start asking for their rights, that young people would turn away from Islam, that they would stop supporting the system. And yeah, in many ways, his fears have come true. There has been a sea of change in this country, and Mr. Big Mouth is almost one of the last very visible ideologues. That's the change he is afraid of.
Now, another person you speak to in the film a number of times is your own New York Times assistant, Somaya. And when you show the film you've done to the Ministry of Information in Iran, he finds her story problematic. Why?
So when he sees Somaya, he says, look, Somaya starts out as this pious woman who studies the Quran. And then in your film, he said, she moves to Tehran. There she divorces. Then she starts to wear a different kind of clothes. And in the end, she wants to move to America. And he said, if you portray this in this way, you might give other people the idea to do the same thing. And you also are actually saying that a lot of women here are changing their lives. And, well, the only thing I could say was that a lot of people are changing their lives, and she is one of those. At the same time, he is also the guy who then says, well, you know what? Here's your next permit. We didn't like everything you did, but make a new documentary. So they also have that tolerance.
It's interesting. At certain points in the documentary, you show us an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and an underground Zumba class. Were people eager to talk to you about the ways they work around laws in their daily lives?
Actually, when we started out taping the first film in 2014, people were much more afraid. It was really difficult to get people in front of the camera. But again, because of those changes in this country, because of the fact that people speak so freely on social media, because they're all on Instagram, people have become much more open about things that might be regarded as bad sides for a country. So at Alcoholics Anonymous, they were very keen in talking about the problems they had.
What comes through in your documentary, for me anyway, is you and your personality. I mean, you're a fun guy. You know, you goof around and you get everybody to laugh. So, I mean, it seems to me that you yourself have a particular advantage in reaching people there.
Thank you. But I think this is the case. If you look at Iran, we would all think that everybody here is very stern. But in reality, Iranians are super funny people that are really easygoing. And that helps also that you can approach them. So I can talk to Mr. Big Mouth and make a joke, or I can talk to someone on the street and make a joke. Because people, you know, they like to talk to foreigners. And that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to make this documentary. I don't want people to watch this and have the feeling that they need to be convinced that Iran is great or that Iran is terrible. I want to provide people with little building blocks for your opinion, if you like, that will help them form their own opinion. Whatever you think of it, it's fine with me, but you now get the chance to listen to normal people living their normal lives, and we rarely see that.
Thomas Erdbrink is the New York Times Tehran correspondent, and his documentary, Our Man in Tehran, airs on Frontline tonight and tomorrow night on PBS. Thanks a lot, Thomas.
Thank you, Carol.
Before we take a short break, here's a preview for a story we'll have on the show tomorrow. It's about family separations, not the ones in the news recently involving immigrant families separated at the U.S.-Mexican border under President Trump's zero-tolerance policy. No, our story tomorrow is about what happened to some Native American families in California in the 1920s and 30s. They had their children taken away by the government, too. The kids were sent to government-run boarding schools. That happened to Connie Reitman's mother. She used to tell her own children and grandchildren about it.
And all of us would lay in the bed and she would be sewing and she'd tell us about things that happened to her in the boarding school.
At first, the stories were about nice things, but over time, the stories grew darker.
As we got older, she related, you know, how at the school, her hair was cut. She was not allowed to talk her language. There was a lot of abuse and hunger, and all she could think of was to get home. For the most part, we didn't hear those parts till we got a little older.
Family separations in another era. That story tomorrow on the show. Still ahead today, the quest for a better, fully recyclable coffee cup. You're tuned to The World.
This podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to our podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics with far-reaching implications, from how venture capital is fueling innovation, to the global shift toward renewable energy, to the economic impacts of President Trump's legislative agenda, and more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Tributes are still coming in for the writer V.S. Naipaul, who died over the weekend. Many of his stories are set in parts of the former British Empire. Naipaul was born and raised in a British colony, Trinidad, to parents of Indian descent. He won a scholarship to Oxford University and stayed in Britain for the rest of his life. His criticisms were often pointed and directed not just at British colonialists. Here he is speaking about Trinidad in a 1980 BBC interview.
I was aware that I was born in a place that was very far from civilization. By civilization, I meant a way of life where the mind and the activities of the mind would be given due regard. Because I myself thought that unless I got to a place where the mind was regarded, I would be crushed and extinguished. And this fear of extinction was the great driving force in my early life.
Naipaul's characters were often adrift, like he was.
One is writing in all these books about people who inhabit entirely separate cultural worlds, and they then come together, and they misunderstand one another, and they lie to one another, and some kind of unhappiness ensues. And they're always different, so the books might seem to be alike, but actually, the material and the people are different.
Naipaul has been criticized for his admiration for the West. He wrote about the, quote, barbarism and primitivism of African societies. He bashed Islam and women writers and admitted to abusing his first wife and his longtime mistress. But Indian writer Pankaj Mishra told the BBC that Naipaul was the foremost chronicler of the post-colonial world.
He describes at great length and extremely vividly and poignantly the simple aspirations of many, many people in these very popular societies of Asia, Africa, the Caribbean, the aspiration for security and stability, simple aspirations which can become incredibly arduous if your social circumstances are very unpromising, if you've been historically disadvantage. And I think Naipaul described those struggles with extraordinary sympathy and compassion.
Naipaul is perhaps best known for his novels A House for Mr. Biswas and A Bend in the River. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2001. You go to the coffee shop, you get your coffee to go. That's what I do. When you're done, you throw the cup in the trash. Yep, I do that too. Or do you put it in the recycling? I'm never quite sure. Starbucks and McDonald's are aiming to end the confusion. They're launching a project to build a more eco-friendly cup. From our Livable Planet desk, here's the world's Jason Margolis.
Good, how are you? Can I get a medium coffee, please?
A lot of us, people everywhere, self-included, are using to-go cups these days.
A recent report said that there are 600 billion cups, billion with a B, that are produced and sold globally on an annual basis. So that's a lot.
Christy Slay is with the Sustainability Consortium. Starbucks alone says it contributes 1% of those disposable cups. That's 6 billion cups a year. And there's a big problem with the paper ones you get there and in other coffee shops.
They look like paper, but they actually have a thin layer of plastic on the inside.
That plastic coating keeps the cups from leaking. Problem is, it also makes the cups really hard to recycle. Only a few facilities in the world can do it. These cups also can't be composted.
And so they get thrown in the trash.
A few companies have rolled out compostable coffee cups, but Dylan DeThomas with the Recycling Partnership says there's a problem with those cups too.
Typically, they're compostable in industrial settings, so, you know, not your backyard compost that you and I might have, but at fairly technically advanced composting facilities.
There aren't a lot of those facilities around either. Added up, companies servicing our coffee habit are in a bit of a conundrum. So the goal of the plan recently rolled out by Starbucks and McDonald's is to build a paper cup with a plant-based biodegradable liner, a cup that would be more easily compostable or recyclable. They're calling it the Moonshot Cup, and they're also dangling a $1 million prize to anyone else who can figure it out. But even with these companies' vast resources, it's proving to be a really big challenge. Starbucks has already tried out 13 prototypes in the past year. So why is it so hard to build a better paper cup?
It's not necessarily very technically hard, although there are technical hurdles to overcome to make something recyclable and compostable.
That's Bridget Croak with Closed Loop Partners, a firm working to build what they call a circular economy. Croak says the big challenge for McDonald's and Starbucks is the systems that are already in place.
Almost anything is technically recyclable, but recycling is a business. And if materials can't move through the recycling system and be turned into a commodity that has value, it's not functionally recyclable.
In other words, even if you can come up with a more recyclable coffee cup, there just aren't enough places out there that can actually make it worth recycling. So along with investing in a new kind of cup, McDonald's, Starbucks, and groups like Closed Loop Partners are investing in ways to improve municipal recycling and composting processes. So when a new cup does arrive, they'll be ready. The environmental advocacy organization Stand.Earth is pleased with McDonald's and Starbucks' efforts, but only to a point. Executive Director Todd Paglia says the companies are misguided in trying to make a cup that's both recyclable and compostable.
If you use a composting cup, what you're doing is you're taking the forest, you're cutting it down, you're making it into a cup that you hold in your hand for 20 minutes, and it goes into compost, which means you have to cut down more trees to make more cups.
A truly recyclable cup is good, but Paglia says the ultimate solution is for customers to start carrying their own reusable mugs or tumblers. And he says Starbucks needs to do more to encourage this.
They are a cultural force in a lot of ways. They need to be one on the issues of waste, and they can be.
Question, though. Is it their responsibility to get me to bring a mug to their store, or is it my responsibility to bring that mug to their store?
It's 100% their responsibility. They've created this problem. They need to solve it.
Starbucks currently gives people a 10-cent discount for bringing their own cup. Paglia says the coffee giant needs to flip that around and charge extra for a disposable one. He says that's the only way to really change our behavior. The company has been trying that out in the UK. Christy Slay of the Sustainability Consortium says if you buy coffee to go even a few times a week and bring your own cup,
that could have a large impact. If you do that over multiple years, you're talking about a lot of cups.
And as Starbucks and McDonald's work toward their moonshot cup, in the near term, most agree bringing your own might be the best solution. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Tomorrow, a whole different approach to the disposable cup problem, inspired by Germany's beer gardens.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. Most Americans don't have a will. 20 years ago, that wasn't a shocking statement. You had to find a trustworthy attorney and pay them by the hour to draft your will. But these days, there's no excuse. LegalZoom has made it easy to create your own will, and they're not a law firm, so you don't pay hourly rates. August is National Make a Will Month at LegalZoom.com. So now it's your turn to take control of your family and assets with an estate plan. It starts with a will or a living trust. And if you don't know which one is right for you, no problem. LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys can advise you on what's best for you and your family. That's why more than 1 million people have used LegalZoom for their estate planning needs. Just go to LegalZoom.com/world to check out LegalZoom's Last Will and Living Trust Estate Plans and get special savings. That's LegalZoom.com/world to take care of your family and save money doing it. LegalZoom.com/world.
I'm Carol Hills. Women in Myanmar want harsher penalties for sex offenders, and their movement is using Facebook to amplify that call.
Because Facebook can use from anywhere, so even you are educated or uneducated, we can use it and we can raise our voices.
Plus, the latest on the push for legalized abortion in Argentina, coming up on The World. I'm I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Argentina is deeply divided on abortion. Last week, tens of thousands of activists took to the streets in support of a bill that would have made abortion legal in the first 14 weeks of pregnancy. The Argentine Chamber of Deputies had passed the bill, but the Senate voted against it. Michelle Oberman is a professor of law at Santa Clara University and author of the book Her Body, Our Laws, on the front lines of the abortion wars from El Salvador to Oklahoma. I asked her about illegal abortion in Argentina and how it compares to other countries in the region.
Well, what I can tell you about is how illegal abortion works generally across all of Latin America and really throughout the world today, which is that it doesn't make abortion disappear. Abortion seems to be at least as common, if not more common statistically, in countries with really restrictive abortion laws as it is in countries that have liberal laws. For decades now, Argentina has been really the destination of choice for upper-middle-class women who are in Latin America in countries like Chile with much more restrictive laws and who don't have the money to fly to the United States to get an abortion that's completely legal. So Buenos Aires is known as a place where you can get a pretty safe illegal abortion. This has started to change in recent decades with the advent of abortion drugs, which have made abortion, illegal abortion that is, safer and more accessible to women without requiring them to travel to a different country.
Now, this bill that was voted on in Argentina generated a lot of attention, a lot of activism, especially from young women in Argentina. What was the catalyst for that outpouring of support? I mean, why did it happen now?
So there have been activists working to reform or to change the abortion ban in Argentina for decades now. But there was a young girl, a 14-year-old, who was pregnant and whose boyfriend didn't want her to have the baby and who instead beat her to death, and her body was found underneath his house. And I think that putting that tragic face on the problem of abortion really catalyzed people across the country, women and men alike, and led to the girl becoming the face of the abortion rights movement, ni una menos, not one less, so that when they went forward with their demands on International Women's Day this past spring, the top of the list was revising the abortion law.
And what do you think are the things that drive people to get abortions? Let's focus on Argentina.
So the things that drive abortion rates in Argentina really aren't a matter of great surprise. There are women that are struggling on their own to raise children. The majority of women who have abortions in Argentina and elsewhere are women who are already mothers. Those women, when faced with an unwanted pregnancy, are not going to be able to easily decide to keep the pregnancy unless there are supports in their lives that make it more feasible. So supports for housing, supports for schools, supports for daycare, flexible work hours. And these things are really the same the world over. We just don't talk about them because we're so focused on whether the law symbolically either protects the image of a fetus being a human being or protects and honors the image of a woman having autonomy over her body. And again, on both sides, the symbolism is really important. Both sides feel it keenly, but neither side can claim that if we change the law to do either, you know, honoring the woman or honoring the fetus, abortion goes away or abortion becomes an easy decision. I mean, the reality is that abortion is a hard decision because it's driven by really tight circumstances that a society, if it wanted to, could begin to change.
Going forward in Argentina, do you think the sort of support for repealing the ban on abortion can be repeated in the future? I mean, there was a whole lot of momentum. I mean, it lost, but there was a whole lot of momentum this time around.
Yeah, I think that the momentum is such that it's going to be pretty easy for the movement in favor of getting rid of the ban to continue. I think what the activists did particularly well this round was to reach across class lines and to mobilize poorer women to care about abortion by naming the fact that wealthier women have safe abortions, even if they're illegal, and that poorer women are the ones who are really carrying the brunt of the abortion ban. And by mobilizing across class lines, they really galvanized a movement that I don't think is going to go away easily.
Michelle Oberman is a professor of law at Santa Clara University and author of the book Her Body, Our Laws, on the front lines of the abortion war from El Salvador to Oklahoma. Our next story takes us to Myanmar, one of the countries where there are concerns about Facebook posts leading to real-life violence. Some of that violence, as you may know, has targeted Rohingya Muslims. Well, when reporter Shayna Sheely went to Myanmar to learn about how people in the country are using Facebook, she heard about another cause that's gaining popularity among Facebook users, a call for the death penalty for rapists. Here's Shayna's story from Myanmar's largest city, Yangon.
At a small gym in downtown Yangon, 21-year-old Thet Wei bench presses nearly double her body weight. Thet Wei is tiny, but she's ripped. She wears a sports bra, spandex tights, and bright red lipstick. She's been coming to this gym for about a year.
I'm going against what Myanmar culture tells me is the way a woman is supposed to be.
A Myanmar woman, Thet Wei says, is supposed to stay inside, keep her opinion to herself, and wear modest clothes.
How do you feel when you're the only one?
I feel strong because
at home, I feel very oppressed as a woman, and sometimes I start to internalize and think that I'm weak. So when I'm lifting weights, it's one of the only times I feel strong.
A few months after she joined the gym, Thet Wei quit her job to train full-time for Myanmar's female bodybuilding competition. She came in third place.
I started getting a lot of attention from other Burmese women on the internet.
In a matter of weeks, Thet Wei got some 20,000 new followers on Facebook, where she started uploading videos of herself lifting, squatting, showing off her abs. But she wasn't just interested in her own posts. She started paying more attention to things others were posting. And what she saw shocked her. Picture after picture of maimed and bloody women, victims of assault. A recent Myanmar government report says the number of rape cases in Myanmar increased by nearly 30% from 2016 to 2017. One day in February, Thet Wei checked her newsfeed to see countless posts about a girl who was raped, beaten, and found dead in a banana plantation outside Mandalay. The case became part of a national conversation about harsher punishments for rapists.
From what I've seen, the majority of these people are repeat offenders, and they'll do it again. Even if someone is given the maximum jail term, which is 20 years, they can still come out and do more crime. There isn't proper record keeping, so you don't know when someone's a repeat offender, and there are no consequences in the future.
Thet Wei was horrified by the young victim of rape found in a banana plantation. She signed a petition circulating on Facebook calling on Parliament to issue the death sentence for rapists. After signing the petition, a group called the Women's Protection Organization approached Thet Wei for a statement of support. And she became one of many internet celebrities, including models and singers, leading the campaign to advocate for the death sentence for rapists. The death sentence currently exists under Myanmar law, but hasn't been imposed in decades. Campaign members organized online and then took to the streets of Yangon and Mandalay. Thet Wei says she became involved in the campaign because fear of sexual assault is part of her everyday life.
I became involved because this is something I see. This is something I live. It's something I see all around me.
Even when she posts her workout videos to her Facebook page, she gets comments from strangers that say things like,
if a woman is dressed like you, like, of course there's going to be rape in the country.
I ask her if she feels scared.
There is definitely fear because these people are showing me their mindsets, a rapist mindset, but also the fear that has been instilled in me through Myanmar culture. Before, when I was young, I would never dare to go outside with a short skirt because I was scared. People talk about the way women dress, but they don't talk about the way our culture is changing. And rape has increased over the years.
Okay, I'm really annoyed by the report that there are more rapes in Myanmar.
24-year-old Evelyn Yuyu Sui is a radio host, a DJ, and founder of a women's self-defense class.
The data shows that more women are reporting rapes. That may be because of all the work that, like, you know, amazing women's organizations are doing to be like, hey, be vocal, speak up about what's going on around you.
When a media organization asked her for a statement on the death sentence for rapist movement, She said no.
I was not on board with that whole thing. There's not really like a discussion about the implications of implementing the death penalty.
For one, Yu Yusui says, it's not always the case that the attacker is a stranger. It can be a family member, and the rape survivor might not want their attacker to get the death penalty. Besides, she says, Myanmar's judicial system is too corrupt to manage the death sentence for rapists. And, she says, it doesn't help anyone.
It doesn't do anything for the person who has been raped or violated.
Yu Yusui teaches a writing class in her free time.
Sentence structure through paragraph, essay, memo writing, emails.
In a recent lesson on how to write proposals, Yu Yusui gave her students the option to propose any topic. The entire class requested to write proposals for the death sentence for rapists. So Yu Yusui decided to switch things up.
Because I had a class that was coming later, which was on like writing with integrity and fact versus opinion. And we moved that up so we could talk about the differences between the data that you see and then what people like extrapolate from the data. And so we, you know, did a class brainstorm on like listing all of the problems, like, okay, why does child rape happen?
What were some of the things they wrote?
People not having very good education, children not knowing how to talk about their bodies, adults not listening to children, adults not knowing about sexuality, not enough sexual education, bad reporting. When we came to proposal writing, everyone decided that we didn't actually have enough data to ask for the death penalty.
At the end, the class finally decided to write a proposal about canvassing in a low-income neighborhood to find out information about how and why rape happens.
So they decided to turn it into a fact-finding mission rather than a, like, you know, kill rapists mission.
Director of women's rights NGO Kin Lay isn't sure if rapists should get the death sentence in Myanmar. But she says the death sentence campaign has put women's voices in the spotlight. When the campaign went viral, Lay scheduled a meeting with members of parliament and told them,
it is the right time for you to consider the people's voices. Politically, you should consider for that rape case because a lot of people are shouting for the death penalty.
They're shouting, Lay says, on Facebook.
Because Facebook can use from anywhere. So even you are educated or uneducated, we can use it and we can raise our voices.
Lay says social media has united women across Myanmar's rural and urban divide to challenge how the government addresses rape and domestic violence.
Now people more and more realize that rape, violence are happening daily. That's why they realize that it is an emergency issue. So that's why they want to have the protective law. We women are, as a whole, we are united and we can challenge them together.
In June, a motion on the death penalty for child rapists was brought to Myanmar's House of Representatives. It was a close call. Over a third voted in favor of the motion, which will be kept on record as Parliament draws up a separate bill to address violence against women and children. Back at the gym, Thet Thet Way says she's proud of the campaign. Because even though rapists in Myanmar won't be subject to the death penalty anytime soon, Myanmar's people and its government are talking about rape. As for Thet Thet Way, she'll keep updating her Facebook status with selfies from the weight room as she trains to be Myanmar's strongest woman.
I'm fighting not someone who will rape me, but I'm fighting the gender roles women are put into. And I'm encouraging others to do this kind of thing so women aren't seen as weak victims and are less likely to have this kind of thing happen to them.
For the World, Shaina Sheely, Yangon.
Shaina's story includes additional reporting from Ai Min Thant and was supported by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. A quick note now on yesterday's successful launch by NASA of the Parker Solar Probe. It's a mission to send a spaceship closer to the sun than ever before. Researchers hope the mission will provide new information about the sun's outer atmosphere. Among those watching the launch in Florida, the man who gave the probe its name, Eugene Parker. The 91-year-old astrophysicist had never been at a launch before.
It's a little like the Taj Mahal. We've all seen pictures of the building and what a graceful structure it is. But if you happen to be in India and stop by that way, there's the real thing, and video and paintings and so forth just don't catch it somehow. Your mind is in a different state when you're looking at the real thing.
Now, Parker says all he can do is wait a few more years until all the data from the probe comes in to learn what we don't yet know about the sun. Melania Trump's parents made news last week when they were sworn in as U.S. citizens. They followed in the footsteps of their daughter, who became a citizen in 2006. They were all born in what is now Slovenia. Melania Trump is not the first lady to be born outside the U.S. That honor belongs to Louisa Adams, wife of John Quincy Adams. She was born in Britain and didn't set foot in the United States until she was 26. Another Louisa, Louisa Thomas, has written a biography of First Lady Louisa Adams. Louisa Thomas, did the fact that Louisa Adams was born in another country affect how she was perceived when she became First Lady?
Absolutely. As much, if not more so, than Melania Trump, I'd say. Louisa was born in 1775, just a few months before shots were fired at Lexington and Concord. And it was a time in which people were really figuring out what it meant to be an American. Obviously, John Quincy Adams was born a British subject, but he grew up understanding that his very life was dedicated to serving this new country. Louisa had a more vexed relationship with the nascent United States because her father was actually an American, but she was really brought up as British girls were brought up of her class and station. And it was really kind of used against her when John Quincy became a political figure.
Now, to be clear, Louisa Adams was an American citizen long before she moved to the U.S. What kept her overseas for the first 26 years of her life?
Her father was a merchant from Annapolis. The idea back then was they would cut out the middleman. So he was the agent over there. And he stayed for a number of reasons, one of them being he had quite a large family. And they actually ended up moving back to the United States, but not until Louisa had married John Quincy. But, I mean, they stayed away for reasons that people, even who identify very closely with their native country, always stay away. It was good for business. They grew roots, and they had a pretty nice life, at least superficially, up there on Tower Hill in London.
What were some of the common critiques thrown at her when she became First Lady?
Well, she was aristocratic, she was British, she was potentially a royalist. She also had this taint because she had been quite a good wife of a diplomat. John Quincy Adams had been a diplomat abroad for many years, and she had shown and really been a huge help to him in St. Petersburg, in Britain, in Prussia. Her ability at maneuvering and really shining in courts in Europe was a strike against her back in the U.S. You know, people were supposed to be very democratic and anti-court. It was very painful for her. She actually defended herself. She wrote an anonymous kind of campaign biography about herself, which she had published, which spectacularly backfired because it only reinforced some of the critique against her that she was, well, for one, power hungry.
You write about an extraordinary trip that Louisa Adams made from Russia to Paris in the winter of 1815. Give us the context for that.
John Quincy Adams was the minister plenipotentiary to St. Petersburg in the early 1800s, right around the Napoleonic Wars, during the Napoleonic Wars, I should say. And during the War of 1812, he was tasked with negotiating the treaty that would end that war, the treaty that became the Treaty of Ghent. And he left her. He left Louisa in St. Petersburg with their 7-year-old son. Once he was done negotiating the treaty, he sent her a letter and said, meet me in Paris. And this is in 1815, which is in a very important year because Napoleon has been tossed in prison, but the ruins and wreckage of the Napoleonic Wars are still, I mean, much of Europe is actually a battlefield. So she, by herself, was tasked with selling or packing up their things. Again, this is not a time when anyone spoke English in St. Petersburg. And she managed to make this incredible trip. It took 40 days. And the really amazing thing is that Napoleon escaped Elba while she was mid-trip. And rumors start reaching her that he's massing an army. And the male servants that she's hired to protect her flee in fear. And she basically is constantly told to stop, that it's too dangerous, that there's going to be another war. And meanwhile, she is literally crossing battlefields. She's arriving in towns in which women are telling her about rape and murders and, you know, really horrible things by these armies that keep passing through and then retreating and passing through again. And it's a really terrifying thing. And she is really brave and resourceful it's a thrilling trip. It really becomes a kind of romantic adventure, but some of the real danger seeps through. But it was something she just sort of ended up using to build her sense of self.
What can you gather about Louisa Adams and John Quincy Adams' relationship? I mean, was he supportive of her? Were they leading parallel lives? What do we know about that?
It was incredibly complicated. And because I was really looking at this journey of an inner life, I was really able to kind of explore the ups and downs of their very complex and very real relationship. There were times in which they were incredibly supportive of each other and incredibly loving of each other, and there are times of real estrangement even. John Quincy could be a very, very difficult man to live with, and she could be difficult too. So it was not always easy for either of them. And the norms, of course, were very different. Really, in those days, support was sort of supposed to run in one direction. You know, she was supposed to be committed to him, and he was supposed to serve her in other ways, but not to support her ambitions or anything like that.
What made you interested in Louisa Adams as a historical figure?
I came across some of her letters while researching independently for another historian, and I was struck by the quality of her voice. It was just so vivid and funny. I don't associate a lot of historical writing with humor, you know? She really had a big, bold voice and a big, grand vision of people's peculiarities and a lot of psychological insights. She also just said it as it was. When you get into the 19th century, you often are reading all these men, typically, who were reading with their future biographers looking over their shoulder. So they were very cognizant of their making the right impression. And she had none of that. She was sort of writing for the people that she was talking to, and she was writing as therapy. And she wrote a lot. She wrote all these memoir sketches. So there was just this wealth of material. And in a lot of it, she's really struggling with a lot of these ideas of identity and emotions and what her marriage means to her and how is it stifling her and how is it liberating her and all these questions I think that we all struggle with. She was doing it and you could watch her in real time. And it was really exciting. It was just such a journey for me to sit alongside her and see both how radically different that era was and also how familiar some of these things that she was wrestling with were.
Louisa Thomas is the author of Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Carol Hills, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.